It's noon, and welcome now to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Lautman's guest this month features Juno Diaz in an interview taped earlier this week. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend How Fiction Works by New Yorker critic, that is, James Wood, newly released by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Thomas Frank's The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, just out from Metropolitan Books. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Carol LaChapelle's new book, Finding Your Voice, Telling Your Stories, published by Oak Park's Marion Street Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at mavenchronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at mavenchronicles.com, a proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
That is so great. Thank you. Thank you. That was just fantastic. Thank you and welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman. This is our fifth season, but our very first time here in our new home with our new partner, the Chicago Public Library, here on stage in the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium at the Harold Washington Library Center. This is just the most thrilling partnership. I can't believe that after 4 years, it's kind of like I died and got to go to heaven. It's just great. And because of that, I have to thank a couple people right away, because without Mary Dempsey saying, yeah, we want this here, this wouldn't have happened. Without Ruth Lednicer, this wouldn't have happened. Leah Vasilopoulos has just been incredible. Everybody here at the radio, the radio station too, at WFMT, where, you know, this is actually broadcast, they've been great. But everybody at the library, thank you so much. We're still in the honeymoon phase, but I'm hoping that if you continue to come every month while it's here, we're just going to be newlyweds forever and ever. It's just a fantastic fit. I also want to thank the MavenChronicles.com, who continue to underwrite this series, Writers on the Record, which for the last 4 years have brought the likes of Edwige Danticat, Anne Lamott, Richard Price, Martin Amis, Edward P. Jones, all these people to Chicago, and dozens of others to participate in this series. You can come, hopefully, for the next 10 years to this. But right now, enough of this preamble. I want to say that I've noticed that when you win the Pulitzer Prize, everything changes. And for one thing, your name is co-opted for all time by those double Ps. They precede your name, they follow your name everywhere, because you've been inducted into the most exclusive, respected, highfalutin club in the known universe. But for book authors, there's also an additional windfall. Those eye-catching gold foils that are slapped on the... Look it, here's one. For all time on every book you've ever published or will publish, even after you're dead and gone. And in the case of our man here, Juno Diaz, copping the Pulitzer Prize was a really hard-earned payoff because his fans had languished 11 years wondering when or if this man was ever going to write his next darn book. Diaz tantalized us with Drown, his 1996 award-winning collection of stories, but then Bupkis, for like over 10 years, until last year when The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao rocked every bestseller list. Now, Diaz's electrifying epic spans the United States and the Dominican Republic, spans six decades, spans an entire family, four generations, all while creating, I think, one of the most unlikely, lovable heroes, overweight, love-starved geek in New Jersey. Along the way, he pays homage to every kind of mutant, Lord Sauron, House Atreides, Triffids, Galactus. Those are just some of my favorite cultural references in it. We are so lucky to have Juno with us here today on Writers on the Record. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I guess my first question is, how does that mantle of Pulitzer Prize actually, are people, you know, shaking your hand all the time? Do they treat you differently? Are you used to it now? Oh, you're still humble.
No, come on now. The best part of it is that no one really cares or really knows. I mean, if you're not hanging around libraries with obsessed book nerds, for the most part, it's kind of irrelevant, you know?
That is so not true.
Okay.
Irrelevant? The Pulitzer Prize, really?
You asked me whether people walking around recognize me and shake it by hand. I said, yeah, man, no one is. Because you're a damn author, you know? You're not a musician. You're not a pelotero. You know, that's the kind of people that get stopped in the street and get harassed. You know, what you do for a living is you put words together to trouble people's sleep. No one's running over to give you a hug, you know? It's like, and I do think that there are, of course, there are personalities, there are celebrities of writers, but I write literary fiction about Dominicans. You will be much more likely to get hugged up on if you're writing about werewolves. So it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing, but I don't think we should get it too twisted.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with a different sort of twisted then. Probably everybody here has read the book. I don't know. Everybody listening may have read the book. But in case you haven't, you don't meet Oscar immediately. Really, the book starts by laying what I think is almost like an infrastructure. You talk about the fuku, which is just a terrible curse that is basically brought to the Caribbean by the white people who discovered it. And link that for all time with Rafael Trujillo, who was the, you know, bloody, rotten dictator from 1930 to 1961 in the Dominican Republic. And that is the structure around which pretty much everything else in the book is hung. Did you start this book with the character of Oscar in mind, or with the idea of really creating this political kind of thing that people had to understand but could only understand it through a kind of a character?
No, I mean, that's a good question. What happened was that I came up first with his entire family came up together, like Oscar. Again, I think this is a product of coming from a very big family, is that I can't imagine individuals. I tend to imagine like little collectives. So I imagined Oscar, his sister, his mother, his dead grandfather, and then his kind of like frenemy junior. This whole relationship came in one lightning bolt. And then what interested me, sort of like at a formalistic level, was trying to discover how to bridge the personal lives of this family and the kind of personal madness with some of my larger obsessions of New World history, some of my larger obsessions of like African diasporic history. And what I discovered was, after kicking around this stuff for about a year and a half, was that I had to deploy a very familiar and time-tested device, which is that anytime anyone wants to link the larger destinies of a nation to an individual, you have to do what, you know, they've been doing since the Bible and since the quote unquote Hellenistic classic period, which is that you afflict your hero with a curse. That a curse has always been a hinge, it has always been a strange pivot that allows you to take a larger abstract history and make it a deeply personal, make it in one flesh. And as soon as I identified that and I saw that this was a common trend, a common narrative strategy, I just jumped all over it. I just jumped all over it. And of course, coming from Santo Domingo, there's a handy curse lying around ready for the use. It's like I was kind of sitting there designing this book and there was this like 800-pound, you know, monster in the room. And I'm like, oh, what curse should I use? And this little guy is like, you know, tapping his fingers. And I think that's the way it approached it. The fuku, while it may seem really interesting and all that kind of stuff, or maybe not interesting, was actually a narrative. It was a solution to a narrative problem. And that's, I think, part of why it works. I mean, again, any time that you create a solution at a narrative level, it works not only symbolically, but it works at the deepest structure of the book, because it's making things happen and it's making all sorts of exchanges of energy and information occur at the book's most capillary level. So, yeah, I know.
I think it was a good decision. Yeah. Well, but when we get to Oscar, then after the whole Foucault and Trujillo and setting us up for what's about to come, we meet Oscar as a 7-year-old when, unfortunately, it's the high point of his life. His
it happens.
Know, everything's downhill from there. And he is just this lover boy, and he loves women, and girls like him, and you compare him in one of the footnotes. Well, there's a whole thing about Ruby Rosa, which one of the many times I went to Wikipedia during my reading of this book. It's like, okay, who was this? Who really was Ruby Rosa? Now I'm hooked on the guy. But at 7, Oscar is a very different creature than he becomes, and it seems so sad and so unfair that he goes from this child who seems to have this amazing future and is beloved to this kid who is just leading really the definition of a tortured life, who hides in the closet to read so he doesn't have to go and play with kids, who has ballooned up to 300 pounds as everybody's making fun of him. And actually, by the time he gets to high school and college, his life seems as though, at least externally, there's nothing happy for this kid. I'm not asking a question.
Yes, I was.
Never mind.
I was waiting for the interrogative.
I know. I'm trying to structure this like a conversation. Man. I can see it to be more direct. Would you mind reading the first reading?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter. It's okay. Now I understand where you're coming from.
Oh, yeah, no. Unless I'm asked a question, I just listen intently.
I'll phrase it as a question.
Yeah.
Okay, so how about this actually you're describing Oscar in this chapter.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, it's almost as if these things are very conscious. I guess you spend enough time in a book and all the accidents that happen are happening at a different level. But the idea of writing about every member of the family, either as an adolescent or as a young person, whether it was a young adult, I found that to be important. I always think that there's this incredible dynamic energy. There's that moment in your life when all the roads are still open, when you haven't made that decision yet to follow one road and all the rest of the roads shut down. And also just, I was obsessed with that idea that, like, you know, in the literature and in history, places like the Dominican Republic are considered in the adolescence of their development. You know, the U.S. is an adult country, you know, but these little brownies are children. So I thought I would just go deeper into that and literally make people children in some ways, you know. So I'm just going to read this part. Oscar had always been a young nerd, the kind who read Tom Swift, who loved comic books and watched Ultraman. But by high school, his commitment to the genres had become absolute. Back when the rest of us were learning to play wall ball and pitch quarters and drive our older brother's cars and sneak dead soldiers from under our parents' eye, Oscar was gorging himself on a steady stream of Lovecraft, Wells, Burroughs, Howard, Alexander, Herbert, Asimov, Bulwer, and Heinlein, and even the old ones who were already beginning to fade. E.E. Doc Smith, Stapleton, and the guy who wrote all the Doc Savage books. Moving hungrily from book to book, author to author, age to age. You could not have torn him away from any movie or TV show or cartoons where there were monsters or spaceships or mutants or doomsday devices or destinies or magic or evil villains. In these pursuits alone, Oscar showed the genius his grandmother insisted was part of the family patrimony. Could write in Elvish, could speak Chakopsa, could differentiate between a slan, a dorsai, and a lensman in acute detail, knew more about the Marvel Universe than Stan Lee, and was a role-playing game fanatic. If he'd only been good at video games, it would have been a slam dunk. But despite owning an Atari and an Intellivision, he did not have the reflex for it. Perhaps if, like me, he'd been able to hide his otaku-ness, but he could not. Dude wore his nerdiness like a Jedi wore his lightsaber, or a lensman her lens. He couldn't have passed for normal if he'd wanted to. Where this outsized love of genre jumped off from, no one quite seems to know. It may have been a consequence of being Antillean, who more sci-fi than us, or of living in the DR for the first couple of years of his life, and then abruptly, wrenchingly relocating to New Jersey, a single green card shifting not only worlds from first to third, but centuries from almost no TV or electricity to plenty of both. After a transition like that, I am guessing only the most extreme scenarios could have satisfied. Maybe it was that in the DR he had watched too much Spider-Man, been taken to too many Run Shaw Kung Fu movies, listened to too many of his abuela's spooky stories about El Cuco and La Ciguapa. Maybe it was his first librarian in the U.S. who hooked him on reading, the electricity he felt when he touched that first Danny Dunn book. Maybe it was just the zeitgeist, were not the early 70s the dawn of the nerd age, or the fact that for most of his childhood he had absolutely no friends. Or was it something deeper, something ancestral? Who can say?
Juno Diaz, reading from The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. And what you can't tell from what he just read is that the second part of that was actually a footnote number 6. And the footnotes in this book are just extraordinary. I grew to just look forward to them. I read comments from people who were like, wait a minute, why are you doing that? It's discombobulating. And I know that you were really influenced by the book Texaco by Chamoiseau.
Yes.
And that there's something about the footnote which was really compelling to you in this. And why you actually described them as fun. It's like you wanted to try it. It seemed like a lot of fun. What is it about the footnote that was drawing you in? Chamoiseau particularly was somebody that you felt, you know, did this in a way that you wanted to try.
Yeah, well, Texaco is one of my favorite novels. I mean, again, it's always kind of a lack of, you know, literary critics get paid, like, certainly enough money to chill out in, like, nice clubs in New York, yeah, to get stuff wrong, you know? So I was always interested in this idea that David Foster Wallace was like the footnote specialist when, of course, none of these cats had ever read Chamoiseau. You know, Texaco and his earlier works is tremendous. And what I adore about Texaco and the earlier works was that here is a Caribbean writer taking what is a sort of a kind of a device that has a long history, a long storied history, and he's turning it into something unrecognizable. Chamoiseau uses footnotes basically to gossip, to launch ad hominem attacks, to just dawdle. Yeah, I mean, there's these great moments where, you know, someone's going to get bit by a shark and homeboy just jumps into a footnote that is totally irrelevant to the issue. And I think that sounds exactly like the lives I am very familiar with. Just that's the kind of game that I wanted to play. I also, if you grew up in a big Caribbean family. There's never this idea of one voice. Nobody can tell a story without somebody interrupting you to have a totally orthogonal conversation. Like, you can come in to report that Godzilla is here, and for some reason, some will feel inclined to launch, like, a comment about, yeah, and the Mets, they're just terrible, you know? And I feel like that's the way most people, despite what we think, despite when we write dialogue or when we imagine the narratives that we like to read, the fact is that human beings never get the script beforehand, you know? And we're just talking crazy most of the time. And it doesn't sound elegant. It doesn't sound smooth. And the footnotes allowed me to introduce that. And finally, footnotes are just cool for a book that's obsessed with dictatorship. And it's obsessed with the idea of authority and authoring, because a footnote, in general, we understand a footnote as a device to, as a device to reinforce authority and erudition. Yeah, that's the traditional usage of a footnote. In this book's case, because the narrator is so troubled by authority in many different ways, even though he becomes a representative by the end, the footnotes are there to, like, undermine the authority of the text. Yeah, and to be the opposite of erudite. I mean, many of the footnotes are deeply trifling. You know, like, deeply trifling. I'm just, like, amazed that you would break a story to launch into someone's, you know, hair style.
Well, you mentioned voices in your family and how everybody's sort of interrupting. It's interesting that you, from the beginning, you were all kind of wondering, well, who is actually telling this, and how do they know so much about all these people? And, of course, it turns out to be Junior. And then we hear about the lives of some of the other characters, and the only other voice we hear for a while is the actual voice of Lola, who is Oscar's sister. And it seemed to me, after I read this book a couple times, that Junior and Lola are actually sort of talking to each other in this book, because at one point she addresses him as you, like, I didn't look at another person again until you. But then later on in the book, there is this moment of, like, two other people just start talking in the book. You create the voices of, I think it's La Inca, the grandmother cousin, and also Yvonne is talking through somebody. So there's a point towards the end where it is almost like a cacophony of voices. Like, who's talking? Wait, it's Junior. No, it's Yvonne. No, it's La Inca. And I thought that was really interesting. It starts in this one solid footing of one voice, one character. And then by the end, it's even more fragmented.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is that, you know, when you read a quote-unquote traditional or a standard novel, no one has any problems with the received omniscient or the received third-person voice, as long as they're not using Spanish. Yeah? Like, no one has any problems reading a book and suddenly material and information is being beamed to you. They're like, as long as it sounds like an old white dude, we're all straight. We have no questions. You know? No, for real. You're like, you don't have any criticism about it. You're just like, oh, this is normal. The voice of authority should sound like this. But what's fascinating is, because the voice of authority, the kind of third person, sounds like this, people went nuts. Not like, it's writing, so maybe three people went nuts, you know? But I found that really striking and incredibly hypocritical. Yeah.
When you say went nuts, what do you mean? That they went nuts because of the all the mix of language in it, or because of who's telling it?
Well, no, the idea that it's problematic that the third person, that there's a first person behind the first person, that it reveals themselves late into the book. And that's a common tactic. That's one of the oldest Victorian strategies in the world. The problem was, again, it's usually a guy with a white beard, you know, doing this. But because, you know, it's a guy talking the way he talks, everybody's like, who is this person? You know, why is he in this book? And what fascinated me about sort of the number of voices is that, depending on how you read the book, you have a different answer on what all these voices are doing. It may sound like a cacophony, the way the Dominican Republic seemed like a normal country beneath Trujillo, you know, underneath the power of Trujillo. But I always think that if you look very closely at a book like this, if you look very closely at any book, what you discover is there's really only one person speaking. And I think that that's sort of the trick of the book. The trick the book pretends to be this this amazing kind of pluralistic kind of, oh, here's a society, here's a collective, here's this these numbers of voices. But when it all comes down to it, it's only you and you're speaking. It's only him, you know, and all these other voices are being filtered through him. And I think that that's one of the, for me, what was very important about the text is, how do people read this? Do they read this as the understanding that this is a person who has an incredible skill at wearing masks? Or do they read this as literally just a bunch of different voices together?
I flunked. Who has flunked?
But you
who
don't
has
have
read
to flunk.
This book and thought...
No, look, there's no flunking. Just because an author has a project doesn't mean they're right. You know?
Okay, we're not going to get into like the fine points of whether you're the dictator or not, because what I want to ask you about now is talk about probably not the question you really want to focus on, but I've got to find out about the mongoose. I'm obsessed with this cosmic mongoose.
Of course.
Somebody said something about, you know, all of the magic realistic overtones in the book, which I thought there was no magic realism. I wish there'd been some more in a couple places just because it was so brutal, but... the mongoose is the one kind of magical, realistic, weird insertion of something that was, I thought, very startling. And there's a great footnote about the mongoose possibly being brought here from aliens, which I was willing to believe. But where does the mongoose fit in your life, Juno Diaz?
Yeah, well, definitely I don't think there's any magical realism in this book either, but hey, I'm the author, so I'm like totally underqualified.
Yeah, so far, you know? I disagree with you on almost every point.
Yeah, but for me, again, a lot of this stuff is like really weird, kind of like nerdy shout outs to stuff. First of all, I'm from Santo Domingo. I'm from the south. My family, my father's from another part of the island, but my mother's from Aswa. And so Aswa is what I know best. And when I was in this part of the country, we have mongoose, and your grandparents would be like, watch the chickens. Okay, my grandparents were like, watch the chickens, because the little chickens would run around. And, of course, you're a little kid, and a mongoose would come up and stand in front of you, and you'd be like, oh, look, a mongoose. You know, and mongoose, of course, are social creatures. And while you're, like, staring at this one mongoose, the other 12 are eating or running off at all the chicken. You know? And I learned a valuable lesson about the Caribbean trickster. And there's a novel by the guy who wrote, you know, the Witch Mountain books? There's a guy named Alexander Key who wrote these books that turned into sort of Disney movies called The Witch Mountains, Escape from Witch Mountain, Return to Witch Mountain. He has a book called Flight to the Lonesome Place. And the mongoose, he has a mongoose in Flight to the Lonesome Place, which has a Dominican character and a Puerto Rican character. And the mongoose was an extraterrestrial. So the mongoose is in this book is actually a reference to a young adult science fiction book. Yeah? And so... yeah, I know.
I think on the magic realism and mongoose point, we're going to now take a short break, just a minute and a half or so. You do not have time to get up and leave. So stay here and listen to the second half of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and our monthly broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. This interview was recorded earlier this week at the Harold Washington Library in the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium. This broadcast is made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. And by MavenChronicles.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at MavenChronicles.com, a proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
Welcome back to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. The guest today in our new fifth season, our inaugural space here at the Harold Washington Library Center, in the Cindy Pritchker Auditorium, and then you're listening to it on WFMT Radio. What a perfect union it is. I am talking to Oscar. I'm not talking to Oscar.
You only wish.
I kind of wish I was, but I'm talking to Juno Diaz.
Yes.
About the brief, wondrous life of Oscar. Wow. Seems like I'm talking to Oscar, but before that.
He'd be more clear.
I need to just tell you that, because I won't have your undivided attention anymore tonight, that coming up next month in October, the best-selling Egyptian author Alaa Alaswani is going to be talking about his new novel called Chicago. And then in November, David Robluski is going to be here with his runaway bestseller, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. You can hear all these past interviews on victorialautman.com going back 4 years, and we'll add Juno Diaz to the mix soon. So anyway, we've got Juno here, and I'm trying not to avoid saying things that are just wrong.
Why? Books?
No, it's okay. I can handle it.
I know, but books are not a test. I mean, the best readings of books are the ones that are, you know.
Well, here's what I wanted to ask you about, and that is. In the next reading, it's from one of the later chapters, and it's going back to the first generation that brings down the Foucault, this curse on the family. And it's really, that chapter is the heart of the Trujillo regime. And, you know, a lot of Americans really are not up on their history of the island of Hispaniola and the Dominican Republic. So some of us are really learning about Trujillo for the first time through this book. I think there's going to be a lot of interest maybe from readers, as I did, go and look up a lot of the characters that you mentioned. Trujillo affected your family very specifically, and then tangentially probably for you and the rest of your siblings. And for Oscar and Lola in this book, they have a really sort of ambivalent relationship with Santo Domingo. They didn't really spend a lot of time there. They were living in the United States, and they were very reluctant to go back. They were really of both worlds completely. And I'm trying to understand how much of that is about Trujillo and the effect that regime had on the families of these kids and you, your family, and how much of that is just being the child of immigrants in this country.
Well, it's hard to separate. You know, I have friends of mine who are, for example, Colombian. Yeah, anybody here from Colombia? Yeah? That's dope.
Two, but they sound like a lot more.
Oh, no, there's more than two. No, there's people in the back, too. So, no, what's so interesting is it's sometimes so hard to divide the issue, where I have friends who are Colombians, and they'll be like, oh, I'm thinking to go back to my country, and their parents are like, oh, no, don't go back there. It's full of crime and the war, what's going on with the rebels. And at that moment, it's hard to kind of distinguish, is it your family is just telling you that because they're nervous about you, or do they really have some sort of socio-political knowledge that you're not aware of, you know? And for me, the question was an open one. I mean, Lola and Oscar, they remind me of the kind of kids that I grew up with, that the thought of going to Santo Domingo at first glance seemed like a nightmare. You know, when they were like, oh, you're going back to Santo Domingo, we were like, oh. Because they would just trap you in your family house, man. And you couldn't get out, and the level of surveillance. But then when you get there, after about 3 weeks, you're like, oh, this is real. This is kind of fly, you know? So some of us, you know? And I wanted the question to be open. What I thought was interesting is that in one tiny family, there could have been a grandfather who was tortured in prison and murdered by a regime, and the grandchildren don't even know about it. And I think a lot of families who come from my experience from Latin America, not all of them, of course, you don't want to generalize, but are carrying these enormous burdens of history. I always say that, like, the kind of stuff that is silently flowing while we're eating cornflakes or listening to the radio in the morning, some of these families, is almost the entire history of the New World. It flows from parent to kid, from kid to friend at this, like, silent level. And I just thought that was wild. I thought that was really, really wild.
Well, and these kids, Oscar and Lola, not only have no idea about their grandfather, Abelard, who we're going to hear about in a second, but they don't have any idea about their mom, Belly, who has endured, like, the most abusive upbringing. And just her life in Santo Domingo was just unbelievable. And before that, when she was, well, and I don't want to give it all away, because actually that's, there's certain areas in this book that are almost like cliffhangers. You make references to things early on. Belly has scars on her back. We don't find out about those scars until much longer into the book, when you're peeling away the layers like an onion skin of this family, until we get to this chapter where it all starts. And actually, that's before you can even comment and tell me I'm wrong. I want you to read about...
This is the effects of trauma, you guys. Repetition. Repetition is the first sign.
This is Jewish, you know? Jewish neuroses.
Yeah.
100% on my part.
No, on my part. So, yeah, man, I'm just going to read a small piece from the Abelard section. Yeah. Again, this is one of those weird things, because these days we're in a society of like total, just total exposure. Yeah, you'll like stub your toe and you'll run out and write a memoir, you know, where other people who are like have been enslaved and tortured, and they can't even bring themselves to bear witness to it themselves. And so part of, I thought, what this was interesting for me is that it was talking about that generation, those people who have gone through so much but have never been able to bear witness to it, yeah, and the silences that are held, and how weird that might seem in a culture where it seems that all of us, as soon as something happens to us, we just want to figure out a way to turn a buck on it. And so this is the part, fallout. This is after poor Abelard's been imprisoned, yeah. The family claims the first sign was that Abelard's third and final daughter, given the light early on in her father's capsulization, was born black. And not just any kind of black, but black, black, Congo black, Shango black, Kali black, Sapote black, Reka black, and no amount of fancy Dominican racial legerdemain was going to obscure the fact. That's the kind of culture I belong to. People took their child's black complexion as an ill omen. You want the real first sign? Not 2 months after giving birth to the third and final daughter, Socorro, perhaps blinded by her grief, by her husband's disappearance, by the fact that all of her husband's family had begun avoiding them like, well, a fuku, by postpartum depression, stepped in front of a speeding ammunition truck and was dragged nearly to the front of La Casa Amarilla before the driver realized something was wrong. If she wasn't dead on impact, she was certainly dead by the time they pried her body from the truck's axles. It was the worst kind of luck, but what could be done? With a dead mom and a dad in prison, with the rest of the family scarce, the daughters had to be divvied up among whoever would take them. Jacqueline got sent to her wealthy godparents in La Capital, while Astrid ended up with relatives in San Juan de la Maguana. They never saw each other or their father again.
I actually wanted him to read longer, but he refused.
No.
He...
My God, do you hear this?
Well, that's a really interesting section. And the whole question of color in this book is so important. There's so many different gradations, and everybody is basically rating everybody else in terms of their color and whether they're Haitian or Puerto Rican. And it reminded me of that story you wrote from Drown that was how to date a black girl, a brown girl, mm-hmm. a white girl, a halfie. You know, these kind of tonalities and sensitivities are something that come up a lot in the book. But one of the other things that particular reading, maybe if you'd gone on a little while longer, would have shown it, but somebody once called you in one of the reviews of this book a linguistic omnivore, because I can't remember the last time I read a book and went so many times to a dictionary, both Spanish and English. And the Spanish, you know, I don't know really much Spanish at all. And I learned a lot from reading this, which was great. But there were words in this book that I thought, where did he come up with that? Flensed, to flense, which, by the way, means to strip blubber from a whale. I was hoping it was something really erotic, but it wasn't.
Oh, yes. That would be tight. Yeah.
And... What is the, oh, Sycorax. Sycorax. I thought that was some weird kind of like neuroses. No, it's the 16th moon of which planet?
But it's also, Sycorax is from Brathwaite, Kamau Brathwaite's poetry, the great Caribbean poet. That was also a shout out to his Sycorax work.
Okay. Know? Well, there's a you made a comment about how incomprehension was something that you actually, you know, built into the book, that the idea that people might have to work a little bit or learn something or not even get every aspect of it, because in normal life we don't usually get probably 80% of what we're presented with. How natural a process was that to you to create that? I mean, did you have to think about, oh, I'm going to find, did you know that Flenst? I mean, really, I was very impressed by Flenst.
Well, Flint's was easy, but most of the other ones were not. Yeah. But look, I think for me, I feel, again, this is probably like my limited point of view, but I feel like the world sounds like this. You know, if we kind of reduce the filter of our kind of, you know, of our own narcissism or our own narrow point of view, you suddenly discover that the world is speaking in multiple voices, and it's a complete, I mean, it really makes hybrid sound like a useless word. And for me, the struggle was figuring out a strategy to render what I think is the linguistic norm. And the linguistic norm is that polyvalence that people are noticing, yeah? And that linguistic norm is that words themselves carry an enormous amount of history. Words have impressed upon them all the history of the old words that they used to be. They carry it as well. And so I just wanted to figure out a way to represent what is the most normal thing in the world, which is multiple voices and multiple languages all just kind of going at it in the most artificial place of all, a book. And so I had to figure out a way to do it. And of course, the strategy, there was no like intellectual eureka like with The Curse. This was just a matter of literally line by line work and seeing how much linguistic torsion, if we can use that word, every sentence would take before it would snap. And how much of these sentences one page could hold before the average person would run screaming from the paper. And, you know, like any work is not meant for everybody. That's what's great about a piece of art. A piece of art isn't a totalizing thing. I mean, you know, that's just art. Art isn't totalizing. I mean, there are other things that are totalizing, but not art. And I knew that there would be people who wouldn't get down, and that's okay. You know, maybe later they'll get down. Maybe something else will happen. But what I wanted to have is that, to try to get to that sort of feeling that you were in a world where language is always changing. Language doesn't care whether you understand it or not before it makes its appearance. And I wanted that to occur. And so it was a line by line. It was a real just add a drop, taste, nope, add a drop, taste, nope, add a drop, too much, start over.
Hence, you know? 11 years.
Well, that also has to do with me being lazy, but, you know.
Well, you actually said at one point that, I mean, you were driven pretty much crazy during this process of writing, and that it's a process of failure to you, or you're just talking about the drop, taking the drop out, but that everything you write you have to tear up 25 times, and it really sounds like there's none of this, okay, I'm thinking about it, I'm writing it, 2 years later, out comes the book, that this is really a tortured process, and you went into the brink of total black depression at one point over it. It's a tough, tough process for you.
Well, it is for me. I mean, most writers, my friends who are published writers who write steadily, they don't suffer as any, like, most of my friends, they pump out novels like they were like little machines and stuff, you know? And part of it, though, I always think that it goes back to this idea that I seem to, it's not like books, anyone's book is that big of a deal just taken by itself, but I seem to really need to steep in my voices a long time before I can write anything, even if it's mediocre what I'm going to write. I need to be with them a long time. But I also seem to need to be completely lost. Like I've got to get off so far off the map. I've got to be so completely lost for me to start making the necessary connections. I do most of my best work and most of my sort of that kind of unconscious structuring of the novel when I don't know where the hell I am. I don't know where the book is going. I don't know why these characters are here. And it's always at those moments that I find myself becoming very, very, I find that are usefully creative. And part of that has to do with you're a writer, you're an artist. I mean, the point of being an artist and a writer is doing something new. Yeah, the Latin root for author is to augment, to add something new. And I think that unless you're completely lost, somebody's been there already. Somebody's been there already. And you've got to be like Gonzo off the page to find something that's even remotely close to being, quote unquote, new. Yeah.
You know, this is a good moment to remind you that we are going to take questions. There are these microphones. You can't raise your hand. You actually have to get up out of your seat, come down here to the front, and we'd be happy to take some questions. It's a great opportunity. We, you know, have about 15 minutes left. So just step on your neighbor, walk out. It's fine. It's great, actually. We encourage you. So somebody get up and do it. Yeah. Because otherwise, I'm just going to keep talking here. I've got a lot more questions.
I had a great it's funny because I'm hoping people in the audience will stand up. But one of my my secret bonds is whenever I see anybody with a book in their hands, you know, it's like the Masons have their secret handshakes and stuff, you know, no matter how that person may seem to me, when they have a book in their hand, it feels like a family. I saw someone out there who was reading Gilead. And it was just a nice bond, even though you don't know the person. You're like, ah, books are working. Yeah, it's like
well,
as long as books
are
working, you'd be amazed. Hey guys,
books are
you'd be amazed. Go
Mary
upstairs.
Mary Dempsey's here. We could use that as a bumper sticker.
Go upstairs and see what whether people are taking out books or checking email.
Okay, somebody get up here now while I ask my next question. And that is that I know you're working on another book that you were starting on before this one. It's called, well, it was called Dark America. And this is where you get to blow up planet Earth. And you were starting this book when September 11th happened, 7 years ago yesterday. And now you're back on it. Is that the next book that we'll see from you?
I haven't written a word on it, so I feel
oh,
like...
Oh, come on. I mean, I'm getting this from, like, your press material, dude.
But now I am here, so I may speak honestly to the material.
None of this is, you haven't written any of this book?
Yeah, look, guys, my mom used to say there was two kinds of people. There was, among other sayings, there was the people who would moan and groan that they failed the test and then would get an A. And then there was people who would moan and groan they failed the test and they would really fail. If I tell you I haven't written a word on it, you can put money on it.
Okay.
That the work has not been done.
Real quick. I was wondering if when you were writing Drown, if you ever had anyone tell you that you had to italicize your Spanish words.
Oh, of course.
And how you reacted to that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, it's that weird thing which has so much to do with who the writer is, right? I mean... You know, Cormac McCarthy has not been italicizing his Spanish and uses pages of Spanish in his work. But you'll never see a review or an Amazon.com criticism about there's too much Spanish in this material. There's too much Spanish in this book. I can't understand any of it. But if you put three words of Spanish and you happen to have a Z in your last name, that's when everybody flips out and everybody has something at stake at attempting to control your language. Yeah. And so my whole thing is my very nature is recalcitrant. You know, I come from a military family. My dad was a military jerk off. To survive, one must be recalcitrant. And I just needed to say no to people because these same people would come up to me and be like, oh, I love Cormac McCarthy. And I'm like, And they still try to do it. Whenever I write an article for like if I write a one page article on I love sneakers. They will literally italicize. We'll go back and forth like 8 times, you know?
Okay.
I really appreciated it that you did that, that you took that stand.
Thank you so much.
Wait, two footnotes. First of all, as far as writing articles about sneakers, you actually wrote an article for Gourmet Magazine about Dominican food in New York and won a James Beard Award for it. That was very important. Footnote number two, the father that was in the military, he was actually working in the Trujillo regime, and it sounds like was your own personal kind of dictator in the household. So you made a reference. I didn't bring it up because I know you didn't want to talk about too much stuff about your family, but...
I still don't.
Okay. And that's why they're footnotes.
Hello, I'm Rafael. I was wondering, you had a story in a anthology called A Whistler in the Night World.
Of course, Lo Conozco.
Kind of was the first anthology to bring Spanish writers who translate and Latino writers who write in English. Where do you stand on that in terms of, you mentioned you were you write fiction about Dominicans, but do you consider yourself a Dominican writer, an American writer who...
Sure.
Is the fact that to put such a label means to have an exclusion from American writers or the American mainstream?
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. Look, it's interesting that this is always, as an artist and as a person, this is always a battle of definition. People are always trying to figure out a way to define you that simplifies you. And if you're like healthy, you're always trying to figure out a way to describe yourself that amplifies your complexity, that represents your complexity. Calling myself a Dominican writer has never felt like it has ever done any damage to me whatsoever. But because I have a different take on what that means, I believe the universal comes from the particular. Yeah, I don't believe there's any such thing as a non-modified writer. Until the 60s in the United States, when people said writer, what they meant was that was shorthand for white dude, usually from New England and from certain places in the South. And so in my mind, calling myself a Dominican writer is basically when I pick up a book by Rick Moody, I'm like, oh, he's my favorite white writer. You know, I think we all, you know, we all have a, in other words, why would I aspire to a universal abstract transcendence that my own community cannot claim? My own community cannot escape any kinds of labeling. We ourselves cannot escape any kind of labeling. And so it just seems like kind of a shady maneuver. And I always liked Langston Hughes's comments on those black writers who just want to be writers. You know, they don't want to be black writers. They want to be writers. And there's a long political discussion in this country about that. But you had a follow-up, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, do you write in Spanish as well, or when do you write? Do you think, you know beforehand you're going to write in English, in Spanish?
Oh,
is
yeah,
that an
yeah,
issue
yeah.
at all?
No, of course it's an issue. Of course. I mean, the question of whether am I more Dominican, am I more American, it's always a bizarre question because you know how people are. People are not like chickens. You cannot, like, divide the dark meat from the light. You can't, like, parse out wings. Yeah? It's very difficult. And depending on who's asking the question, they already have ideas of what that answer might be. So in the Dominican Republic, if you're writing in English, you're not Dominican. Even though English is a normative part of the Caribbean experience since its inception, even though in the Dominican Republic we have entire ethnic communities of Anglophone Caribbeans who have maintained their English alive and well in Santo Domingo. And this battle of definitions is occurring at a national level. And artists tend to provoke categorical anxiety, especially an artist that says that, oh, I speak English, I live in the U.S., and I'm like, I'm Dominican. And people immediately flip out. Because, you know, it's much easier to be like, you're from the United States, be quiet and stay there. But then again, the lines between the United States and the Dominican Republic have never been clear. Usually the people who are telling me that I'm not Dominican are working at an American firm in Santo Domingo, driving a Japanese car, you know. They're all dressed like you're dressed or like I'm dressed. They look more gringo than three gringos, you know. But they're like, no, I have the definition, I have the key, and you're not it.
Hola, saludo. What would be in your books, in Drunk, Oscar Wilde, you speak about, there's something that came out, which is about race, and it's about the experience of Dominican outside Dominican Republic in the U.S. as an immigrant. What would be the role of the Dominican community who live in New York or any part of the U.S. respect the experience that Haitian immigrants are having in Dominican Republic based on the discrimination based on color or other.
No, it's a wonderful question. I mean, look, this. It's interesting, the Dominican Republic, we have what the Dominican government would call a Haitian problem. We have Haitian immigrants, and that's a problem. On the other hand, this same Dominican regime mailed a million poor Dominicans to the United States and Europe, you know, and but that's not a problem. And I think part of what ends up happening always, especially at a society like Santo Domingo, which is a society that lives or dies by the money that its immigrants send, its diaspora in some way supported, is that there's an utter disconnect from the Dominicans who are supporting the country and who live in the United States, who live in Europe, who live in other parts of the Caribbean. We're not being consulted. We're our intellectual and our experience, our intellectual energies and our experiences as immigrants are not in any way being taken into account. The Dominican Republic just wants our money. And they don't want the knowledge that our experience has generated. Because if the knowledge of our experience was generated would be factored in to Santo Domingo, no one would be treating Haitians the way they're treating them. So in a way, the country maintains its sort of closed, insulated point of view by taking our money when we come visit, giving us some bottles of rum, kissing us every now and then. But they're like, go home and don't bring that seditious knowledge of what it means to be an immigrant, which all immigrant collectives can undermine a nation because they bring back information that nations don't actually want to look at too closely, which is that we're all dependent on people that we claim to not like or we like to discriminate, that there's no such thing as a pure nation, and that the myth of a strong nation is nothing more than a myth, you know?
Speaking of nothing more than a minute, that's exactly what we've got left. So I'm sorry. I know there's a lot of other people that want to ask questions, but, you know, he'll be available signing books. So we've got that. And the one last thing I just want to mention is that you did sell these film rights to Miramax at some point. So we're going to be, I think, seeing Oscar Wilde in movie form, which probably terrifies and delights you.
Well,
I've got to get one of those right.
No. I think that I don't know. I always say this. One of my favorite books from the early 90s is that Caleb Carr novel.
Oh, yeah.
The Alienist.
The Alienist, yeah.
The Alienist sold like 22 million copies, and they still ain't made it into a movie. Hollywood is a mysterious place. Why things get made and other things don't get made, there's no way of understanding it. So, my agent sold the rights. Now we just wait and see what they do with it. My greatest fear is they're going to do the Ursula K. Le Guin's Wizard of Earthsea, where they're going to cast all the characters as white, you know. but otherwise, you know, we just wait and see. It's wait and see, you know.
Well, Juno Diaz, it's been such a pleasure to have you here talking about the brief, wondrous life of Oscar Wilde for the inaugural Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman. Thank you so much for
Thank
being
you.
Here.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman. Our special thanks to everyone associated with the series at the Chicago Public Library, at the Harold Washington Library Center, including Commissioner Mary Dempsey. Engineers for the broadcast are Eric Arunas and Leland Mosley. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer is Victoria Loutman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Loutman are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually 3 Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend How Fiction Works by New Yorker critic James Wood, newly released by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring Thomas Frank's The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, just out from Metropolitan Books, and the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton, specializing in cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more. Discover Carol LaChapelle's new book, Finding Your Voice, Telling Your Stories, published by Oak Park's Mary Street Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago. Stay tuned next for the BP Chicago Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast.